Hello, everybody, and welcome to this year's first podcast episode of Tales from the Doghouse.
Separation Anxiety Explained.
I am Stacey Bell from Focused Fun in the U.S.
And I am Ness Jones from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoders. Stacey, I'm so excited.
I am too. I kind of missed our chats
when we
took a break this summer, or not this summer, this holiday season. What are we talking about today?
Well, Ness? Before we get to that, I would just like to say that we are on season four.
Whoop! Season four, episode one.
So anybody watching, listening to this for the first time, you could be watching on YouTube or you might be listening on a podcast. There are a ton of episodes that you can go back and listen to should you choose to. So not so much on YouTube because we only just started that mid last year, I think. But yes, podcast episodes galore.
So today we are talking about setting yourself up for success with separation anxiety training. So in my mind, I kind of have like four steps or areas that we need to like really look at and address to be successful with separation anxiety training. So I actually did a outline for this, which I felt really good about myself for.
It looks more like a flowchart.
a little bit like a flowchart too. So I think for me, the first step is forming your team. And with a lot of behavioral struggles with dogs, and of which separation anxiety is one, you really need to take a team approach to be successful. So one person in that team is your vet. And Ness, what are some reasons we like to make sure the vet gets involved with on the team?
Oh, Stacey, I'm glad you asked me that. There could be something that is affecting the dog that makes it hard for them to stay at home alone. So it could be a number of various issues, cognitive decline for seniors. It could be something to do with pain, could be allergies, any kind of gastro issues make it very difficult. So it's really, really good to get a vet check first and rule out something that we might be able to address before we even start the training that will help.
Yeah, definitely. And interestingly, Daniel Mills' group recently came out with a paper where they looked at different vet behavior practices in, I think they were mostly in Europe, but I would have to go back in the paper and look. But when they were like doing surveys of the dogs with, behavioral struggles, they found that 20 to like 80% of the dogs in their practices had pain as a factor in the behavioral struggle that they were going into the office for. So that's kind of a big deal. It's a very wide span, 20 to 80%. But even if we're looking in the middle of that, or even if we're just looking at the 20%, the low end, that's still worth something, worth looking at with your vet. Mm. And like we've talked about before with pain issues, a lot of times those are hard to diagnose in the vet office. So if you're noticing any changes in your dog, they're in their gait, in the way they get up or lay down, that's a really good opportunity to take a clip of video so you can bring it with you on your visit.
That's a good point, yes, because obviously lots of dogs don't like the vets, so they can get tense. And
yes, they can get really tense. The other thing that having a vet on your team is really beneficial for is for medication. So if the team decides that behavioral medication can really support your dog through the behavior modification of becoming, going from feeling scared when home alone to feeling comfortable or safe when home alone, then your vet is going to need to be the one to prescribe that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't already have a vet, when you're looking for a vet, I would, you know, make sure the vet is savvy with anxiety related behavior issues and also with the meds to support that, because different vets have different areas of specialty. So if you are looking for a new vet, just doing a little extra legwork and asking those extra questions can be really helpful.
I think it's also important to note that, you know, if you're seeing, and I'm talking about pain related stuff now, so, but if you're seeing changes in your dog's gait or, you know, something going on there and you take your dog to the vet and they say, oh, there's nothing wrong with it, don't accept that. Maybe if you know in your heart there's something going on, maybe go and find another vet. I know in America it's pretty tough at the moment because I think many, and so certainly in some areas, you can't take your dog, you can't go in with your dog. So a dog that's going to freak out at the vets and you're not there, they're going to get more freaked out. It's hard. So maybe look at a home vet or just say to your vet, can we do this if it's, you know, a gait examination out in the, you know, outside? In the parking lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that I can be there to comfort them. Yeah, and make sure that they're
okay. That's a really good point. It was really funny. Not really funny, but I took Rowan and Sadie, the cat and the dog, to the vet for just their well check vaccination kind of visit. And, they took Rowan in the back to weigh him, which he's okay with that part, but they also tried to get a urine sample, by walking him outside, which I wasn't thrilled that they did that without asking me, but he wouldn't pee for them because he wasn't comfortable with them. And I was like, and so when the vet tech came back and told me, I was like, oh, we can go out together and I'll walk him in and you can grab the sample, because, you know, if he's not comfortable, he's not going to do that. And so it's kind of that same thing, is that having that secure base there will allow your dog to relax more, which will allow the vet to either get the sample they need or see the gait or, you know, whatever the case is, that can make a really big difference for a lot of dogs.
While we're still talking about vets, I also think it's really important to note that gut issues can cause anxiety issues. The gut is linked to behavior. So make sure your dog is healthy in terms of what's going on in their gut. Make sure.
Yeah. And so, so some of the signs that you might see that your dog doesn't have a healthy gut is, obviously you're looking at the output, right? Like, so if your dog has soft stools a lot or diarrhea, or if they vomit a lot, or sometimes licking a lot can be an indication. So either licking their paws, well, which could also mean allergies, but licking.
But allergies are connected to the gut as well. So.
So if you're seeing that your dog is doing those things, that would be a really good reason. Because it could be gut issues and it could be like a parasite issue with worms or something like that if they're having diarrhea often. But that's not. Just like with people, if you had diarrhea every day, you would follow up on that. And so we need to do the same with our dogs. Sure. Allergies is another issue that can contribute because it's that kind of low level but chronic discomfort. And that can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you see a drastic change of behavior, right? Or even just a change of behavior that's not super explainable, that's a good time to dig a little deeper.
Yeah, for sure.
Who else is on your team?
Who else is on the team?
Okay, so we have forming your team. You first want to make sure you have a vet. And usually before working with a behavioral professional, which is number two, look for an SA pro to help guide you through. Usually they're going to want you to see your vet, especially if you haven't seen your vet recently. So expect that to be kind of part of the picture. But what do SA pros or separation anxiety professional behavior consultants do to help you help your dog or support your dog through overcoming separation anxiety?
Oh, well, I mean, step-by-step plans. I mean, we watch the videos, we guide you, hold your hand and take you step-by-step through your training journey, and we're there to support, not just in terms of how to do the training, what to look for, what your next step is, kind of take the thinking out of it for you.
Yeah.
Also just there as an emotional support too, which I think is really important. So
it is
important. You know, when you're having that hiccup, when you're having doubts, you know, that we're there to say, you know, normalize regressions of variability for starters, but just, you know, talk you through it on an emotional level as well. But
right.
Mostly the fact that, you know, we can provide step-by-step training, daily plans,
right,
supervised, and take the thinking out of it for you. So you don't think about what your next step is.
Yeah. And I think in addition to the step-by-step plan, we can provide you with like an umbrella plan. So, you know, we're looking at not only what are you going to do for your next training exercise, but what does the whole picture of your training look like? Do you need to have different scenarios? Do we need to, you know, look at it, which is another point. So I won't talk at a lot about it here, but, you know, do we need to add other things to your dog's life to set them up for success with training? Right. So yes, we're looking at the providing a plan, but also like, are your goals realistic? Are you training consistently enough? Are you, you know, and really be that source of accountability as well as helping you formulate a plan.
Mm. And making sure that your dog's not going over threshold as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a huge one.
Undermine your training. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because a lot of times you, what I see with people who aren't working with a professional that specializes in separation anxiety is that they often train without a plan. So they'll do a training session, but they don't know like what their target duration is. So they just stay out until they see a sign of anxiety and then run back in, which is just exposing the dogs to low level anxiety every time they go out, which backfires. Mm-hmm. So that is an important piece for sure. Okay, so in addition to your vet and your separation anxiety professional, you're also going to want to build your village. And so what I mean by building your village is people that will help you manage absences with your dog, to not leave your dog longer than they're comfortable, but allow you to have some time to live your life, right? So there are going to be places where you can't take your dog. And so we want to make sure that you can still do those things. And so we want to make sure that you build a village. So some areas that you can rely on, family, friends, neighbors, those are often good choices because usually you don't have to pay them. Sometimes you can swap services, you know, I'll mow your lawn if you watch my dog kind of thing. And if it's family, they'll typically support you in that way if they're nearby.
Yeah, and then you've got the paid ones like doggy daycare, pet sitters, all those sort of things.
Rover, yeah. listing on like your neighborhood, if you have a neighborhood Facebook page or a neighborhood next door is like an app that some neighborhoods have here.
It could even be somebody you meet if you do take your dog to the dog park, your dog might have a little play buddy and you can do reciprocal babysitting.
Yep. The other one thing to just make sure of though, when you're looking for a sitter, is to keep your dog's needs in mind, right? So like if your dog is a coloring book kid, hanging out, you ever heard that? Like, so you know how kids will have different personalities. A coloring book kid might be the kid who like sits at the park and reads or colors while the other kids are playing on the playground.
Right. I've never heard that. Okay.
You know, and so they kind of hang back a little bit, right? Ooh. And do more observing and, you know, participate when they're comfortable, but it might not be a straight in like, yay, we're at the dog park kind of thing. And then there are those kids that, you know, or dogs that just want to jump right in. So I think the big thing is like knowing your dog and putting them in a environment that allows them to thrive, right? So yeah. If your dog gets overwhelmed, if there's more than two other dogs, then doggy daycare is probably not the best option, unless it's a private home daycare where they do only take limited number of dogs, right? So just really asking those questions and making sure that it's a good fit for your dog, because if it's a stressful experience for your dog, then you're not supporting them as well as you could. I mean, it's certainly better than being home alone, but that's a good thing to take into account.
Yeah. I think one thing we do need to say, when we talk about managing absences, is because I know one of the initial reactions people have is, what? I can't leave my dog alone. That makes no sense. But it's only while we're doing the training. So while we're doing the training to get your dog past this issue, it's essential really to make sure that your dogs, if you do have to go out, that they're not left alone to go over threshold, which is going to, again, undermine your training.
Right, right. Yes.
So, yeah, yes. It's important. It is important.
It is very important. So once you have your team formed, it's important to look more at the whole big picture of what your dog's life is. So setting your dog up for success by looking at things like nutrition and choice in their daily life, and safety and security. Mental enrichment, physical enrichment, social enrichment, all of those pieces. Because if your dog is not fulfilled, then the process of learning to be home alone and comfortable is more difficult for them, right? So we really do want to look at that full picture.
And if you know what your dog's genetics are, it's good to try and tap into their specific drives as well. So what appeals to a Dachshund, which is, I don't know how many people know this, but I find it really fascinating that they used to hunt badgers. They are such brave little dogs. They used to go down those badger holes and hunt badgers, which are quite scary, and they've got big claws.
Yeah, they are.
So they're brave little dogs, but they like burrowing. So, you know, that might be more appealing, finding something in which they can burrow into, even if it's just your bedding or what have you.
Yeah.
But what might be more appealing to a German Shepherd might be tracking, like tracking a scent or something like that. Whatever your dog's genetic drives are, if you know what they are, try and tap into them.
And a lot of my clients have rescues, and so you might not know, or you might know the genetics and your dog just might not really like the things that they're quote unquote supposed to.
Yeah.
And so just watching what your dog does, what activities they do when they have the choice, right? So if you catch your dog digging in the garden a lot, well, your dog likes to dig, right? So maybe build them a sandbox or something like that, you know, an area where it's allowed. I had a client with a dachshund that, and I know we say it differently, covering it for the US, but she sent me a picture of a dead mole one day and was like, Penny's enrichment for today. It's like poor mole, but she did get to do something that was fulfilling, you know, a species specific behavior that was fulfilling for her. So I thought that was kind of funny that she thought of it in that way, which is, I mean, good that she thought of it in that way. Oh, you don't have moles over here? We have lots where I am.
Oh. Are they they're what do they do? Just burrow underground?
Yeah, they burrow underground.
Yeah. Okay.
Rowan does this stalking thing. So he'll be we have a little bit of land and he, you know, will be just off leash walking around, and then all of a sudden he'll stop and cock his head. And then he does that jump up thing like you see fox do, you know, like jump up and then pounce on it, and then he'll start digging. It's kind of cute. I keep on meaning to get it on video, but I keep on forgetting.
Yeah, right.
In the moment, you know. But like for instance, I have a new client and she, their dog likes to shred things, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, let's add that to the enrichment program then and give a cue so that the dog kind of knows this is an acceptable thing to shred. not everything, but this is kind of like the sandbox thing. Like, I don't want you to dig in my garden, but you can dig in the sandbox. Yeah. So dogs are really good at making distinctions, so they can do that. So, but definitely fulfilling the things that you see them gravitating towards. Like if your dog is a kind of a scavenger, likes to do some counter surfing and stuff like that, then providing some foraging opportunities might be a good thing, not necessarily on the countertops, but like some scatter feeding or something like that.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So formed your team.
Can I talk about exercise briefly? So exercise is mm-hmm. equally important as enrichment. obviously, yeah. We don't, you know, it has to be age appropriate. So if they're puppies or seniors, we've got to keep that in mind. But also we need to look at exercise in more than one way. So not just physical health. Obviously, it's going to keep your dog fit and healthy, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But exercise builds confidence. It creates a healthy frame of mind. It makes, you know, optimism. It's like if you look at it from a human perspective, if you're feeling depressed or anxious or whatever, mm-hmm. your therapist maybe might say, go and get some exercise, get out, mm-hmm. get some fresh air, mm-hmm. get some exercise, get those endorphins happening, all that sort of stuff. So it's really good for us and it's really good for our dogs as well, not mm-hmm. just on, you know, on a physical level, but also on a
mental level,
emotional, yeah. mental level as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the same, right? Like if you went to a counselor or a psychologist, they would say nutrition, rest, exercise, you know, all of those things. And it is the same for our dog. So if your dog, just looking at the balance being part of that, if your dog is getting a lot of exercise but doesn't know how to rest or settle, then you're going to want to work on that settling, the turning off bit. Mm. But with exercise, I think, you know, low-key exercise is important in some ways and like depending on the age and the needs of your dog. And also some more intense exercise, tug, fetch, going for a trail run or, you know, whatever, those would be like more intense exercise. Do your dogs do bite work?
Not really, not anymore. They were, but
not anymore. Yeah. But that would be considered a more intense exercise. But certainly swimming is a good exercise, especially if your dog is starting to experience some arthritis or joint pain. So there's so much as far as physical enrichment goes that you can do with your dog. And it is just like the other forms of enrichment, is that you have to cater it to what your dog enjoys, what their capabilities are, all of that. Mm. So we have forming your team, setting your dog up for success. The next one is to train consistently. So for my clients, I usually recommend that they train 5 to 6 days a week. Some of them train more than once a day, especially if they're on lower duration. Some only train once a day, and that's really dog dependent. What do you recommend for your clients, Ness?
Usually 5 days a week, but yeah, again, if they're on a low time, it could be twice a day. I do, before we actually touch on this stuff, I think we do need to also mention, in terms of setting the dog up for success, the importance of having a live camera feed so that you can watch your dog. So
yes,
we need to be able to watch the dog while you're doing the training. So not recording it, because when you're recording it, you're watching it back later and you're not seeing it. You know, you can't come in if the dog's struggling. So we need to be mm-hmm. live camera feed. That doesn't have to be difficult. It could be just a Zoom call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, yeah.
It could even be a Facebook Live, but set it to only me, not public. We don't want anybody to watch.
Yeah. The problem with, yeah. I mean, what you ideally you would want to be watching it and recording it, because then that would allow you to look back and say, okay, well, I noticed when Snuffy whined, but before he whined, he, you know, fill in the blank, whatever he did. And maybe he was showing low levels of anxiety before he did that behavior. So being able to look back on your sessions is really important. And if you're working with a professional that specializes in separation anxiety, they're going to want you to record your sessions. So that is something that's worthwhile taking some time to learn how to do.
Yes. Yeah. So you can, and I mean, there's options. You can buy cameras as well. So, whatever, it makes it easier. Initially, you don't need to fork out a ton of money, though.
And there are so many inexpensive but quality options for cameras these days. Mm. So you don't have to fork out a lot of money to set up a system. the other thing is, we've talked about it a lot on the podcast, and I think we've even already mentioned it on the show, but making sure that you're training at your dog's pace. So, the approach that we take is really nuanced, because we're wanting to set your dog up for success in every exercise. So we're not going from 5 minutes to 10 minutes to 15 minutes. We're not that chunky with our steps. We want to make sure we're, at a place where your dog can be successful. So the steps look, kind of small in the beginning, especially, but then they do. Just like thinking of it as a barely noticeable change to your dog, but over time, those barely noticeable changes accumulate and allow you to, like Bria, who we had on the show, is like at 4 hours and 15 minutes. She did have, like, since the show, had an injury that she had to take some time off for. So I'm really proud of them for taking those tiny steps to get to that big chunk of time where she can go out to brunch with friends and all of that kind of stuff. So that's really awesome.
Yeah. And I think it's quite hard for people to deal with, like, they're like, well, this is going to take forever, because maybe the increase is 15, 20 seconds, could be even less than that each time they train. And they're like, well, we're never going to get anywhere. But they do actually add up to
something. And thinking about it another way is, if you do nothing, then your dog will still be at 0 seconds of being uncomfortable while home alone. But if you commit to the training and the process, then, in a year, your dog might be able to do 4.5 hours. And that might be your goal. So,
And if you do decide, well, I'm going to do the training, but I'm going to push my dog and consistently push them, you're going to be right back at square one anyway.
That's true.
Follow the program.
Yep. Follow the process, which kind of leads us to our next point, which is, making sure that you're setting your expectations and goals. And so what I mean by that, and making sure they're realistic. So what I mean by that is, you will hear us say, and probably others say, that separation anxiety training is a marathon, not a sprint. And that's true for all behavioral issues, really, is that they don't resolve overnight. So just recognizing that it is a tiny step approach, and all of those tiny steps accumulate to make, to allow you to reach that 4-hour goal or whatever your goal is. But that committing to taking those tiny steps and set your dog up for success and training with a plan, they're all really important pieces to reaching your goals. Mm. Another kind of expectation setting one is one that you already mentioned, Ness, and it's that variability and regressions are kind of a normal part of separation anxiety training, right?
Yeah. If we can drill down and find out why there's a variability or a regression, then we can, hone in on that and address that. Sometimes we don't know why, we can't figure it out, but we just have to deal with it.
Right. Yeah.
And like you say, accept it as normal and reset, and hope, it shouldn't be you know, should maybe hopefully the times will go up a bit more chunkily than when you are building those foundations in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. And just knowing that you always want to be seeing your dog win, right? So if you get to a place where your dog is struggling on their exercises more consistently than they're acing them, then that's a clear sign that you need to be stepping back and making things easier for your dog. And we did do a whole episode on using scenarios and training. So how your dog might find it more difficult to train in some circumstances than other circumstances. And then by separating those out into different scenarios, we can allow our dogs to proceed at the pace that they're comfortable with in each of those scenarios. So yeah. There's a whole episode on that, but it can be things like time of day, day of week, their activity level, the weather can sometimes be a factor for some dogs, who's doing the training, stuff like that. While we can make tweaks to the protocol, the underlying protocol is still the same though, to be training at your dog's pace, to set them up for success, to train with a plan, to train consistently, all of that remains the same. My final thought is, like, when you're thinking about goals for your dog, as far as how much duration they can be home alone for and still be comfortable, I think it's kind of a longer conversation, or it can be, and it can become a kind of a heated topic sometimes in groups. I really personally don't like to leave my dog more than 4 hours, five tops, without a potty break or, you know, a break in some exercise. Do you kind of have a rule of thumb for your dog's nest, or?
I don't go anywhere.
But if you did.
I don't really know. I mean, it.
Are you a hermit?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. I didn't know.
I'm a real homebody. I am a homebody, yeah.
Okay.
Currently at the moment, if I go out, it might be 2 hours tops. But I. Okay. You know, I know people can't, unfortunately, life happens and, you know, not everybody can leave, say, well, I'm going to get home and take my dog out for, you know, at the 4 hour mark, mm-hmm. or what have you. So sometimes we just, you know, unfortunately have to accept that. And mm-hmm. I know it's not ideal, but there are going to be people
yeah.
that say, well, usually, I don't have an option. And if my dog's comfortable for 8 hours, then that's mm-hmm. all I can
yeah.
do. Yeah.
Usually when, you know, especially, you know, I only take separation anxiety cases. So, you know, to me, starting from 5 seconds and thinking about 10 hours alone, I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
But what I suggest in people who want to leave their dogs for a longer time than may be fair to expect a dog to hold their bladder, is having a dog walker or a friend or a neighbor or somebody stop by in the middle of the day to give them a break, maybe toss the ball for them a few times, and then, you know, go back to being alone again. But just that, you know, from A, that enrichment standpoint, and B, holding their bladder, and just are those goals reasonable for that particular dog? And yeah. and again, it's you're always looking at the specific dog to see, is that reasonable for this dog?
Yeah. I mean, years ago when I worked in an office, my dogs were at home alone for 7 to 8 hours. I worked closer, but the office moved. mm-hmm. And it would have been a 2 hour. By the time I got back, did something with the dog, came back, it would have been gone for like 2 hours, which mm-hmm. was unacceptable. But again, my dogs were fine. They didn't have separation anxiety, so it's completely different.
Right.
And they were quite capable of, you know, they were happy to go throughout the night without a potty break. So, and I also made sure that they always went out in the morning and they had plenty of exercise and plenty of enrichment and, you know, all that stuff that was needed.
Yeah.
So that they could settle when they had to be home alone. And it often, mm-hmm. you know, often because my husband would leave early and then I would leave and then he'd be home before me, you know, might have been 6 to 7 hours, but they did have to last longer than 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
This is years ago. I mean, years and years ago.
Yeah. 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 And there are a lot more options now than there used to be. At least I wasn't aware of, you know, dog walkers. When I had my first dog, you know, I wasn't aware of dog walkers and Rover and all of that kind of stuff. Mm. So that's a fairly new option to help. And in some areas of the country, not all of them and not all neighborhoods and not everybody has a yard set up this way, but some people do have doggy doors that allow the dogs to kind of take themselves out and get a little bit of a change of scenery. So that can be an option, but you know, in some areas that's not safe. So again, it's a good discussion point to have with your SA Pro trainer or your separation anxiety professional, because they can kind of have that conversation with you, right? Like, what is realistic given your situation? What can we expect from this particular dog? What are the options to fill the gaps? Those types of things. So I think that's an important one to have.
I think also one thing we should touch on, and we've done this on plenty of other episodes, but just be aware that when we are trying to set our dogs up for success, that other than things like pain, et cetera, that there could be things happening in their lives that might destabilize the training. So, you know, moving house is always a big one, but if there's a breakdown in relationship in the house and, you know, there's tension in the house, if somebody leaves, you know, kid going off to uni, or maybe somebody new coming into the house, anything that is out of their normal, out of their routine, unsettles them, can also affect your training. So it's good to acknowledge that, be aware of it, and then maybe you might need to step your training backwards. Again, conversation to have with your behavior consultant. But it's, if we're aware of that, then, and also how we're feeling. So if you're upset about something, if you're being impacted by something in your own life, that could also affect your dog as well. So if we can be aware of that and then say, okay, well, maybe we need to adjust the training for the dog if they're not coping for whatever reason.
Right. So just as a brief recap, four areas of separation anxiety training are a way to set yourself up for success with separation anxiety training is to form a team, to set your dog up for success, to train consistently, and check your expectations and goals.
Thank you for listening to the first episode of season 4 of Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. I am Ness Jones from Separation Anxiety and Dogs Decoded in Australia. And if you are starting your training journey and you need to speak to a behavior consultant that specializes, is certified in separation anxiety, reach out to one of us. Isn't that wise, Stacey?
Yep, you really should. Thanks for joining us today, guys. I am Stacey Bell from Focused Fun. We will see you next episode.
Oh, and one more thing. We do work remotely, so it doesn't matter where you are in the world. We can help you. We don't have to live in the same city. I think that's really important. And the other important thing is make sure you like and subscribe, whether you're watching us on YouTube or whether you are listening to us in your ears on a podcast.
All right.
Cool.
Thanks for joining us today.
Bye.
Bye. I'm going to go to the hospital.